talking with them in Chinese, since you are here.
No, I
think just for
clarity, I think they're 100% English. What you
normally do. then we speak in Chinese, and then you begin to get very puzzled every moment. Okay, so we have to use English to teach this anyway, so because English is one of the, to teach WTO law, because English is one of the three official languages in the WTO, and the three languages do not include Chinese, Spanish, and French, and Spanish. And Spanish. So that's the three official languages. And when you, China has been involved in a number of WTO disputes, and we have to study the English language, the English legal text, rather than the Chinese translation, because you can't just analyze the legal rules in Chinese. The sequence of the words is totally different. The other way around. So we have to use English to study WTO law anyway, right? Okay, Mr. Is world trade law useful? Right? For many of you, it isn't. It isn't. It's because it concerns mainly the government and the government, and sometimes the multinationals. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the chance, the opportunity to work for the government, then it makes no sense to you. Professor John Jackson, however, mentioned to us some examples that it is still possible that you are the advisor to the policymaker, or you yourself is the policymaker. Someday you might work for the government, right? Mm-hmm. Work for the government in Beijing, or work for the government here in Shanxi. So if you are the minister of trade in the country, then WTO law matters a lot to you. Matters a lot to you, right? For example, in this example, that if you are you're trading partners, they are very powerful, and you are bullied in the bilateral trade relations. Then what can you do? Right? What can you do? And then the WTO as a multilateral organization certainly has some rules to help you. Or if you're a lawyer advising a multinational company, right? You're a general counsel of a multinational company. WTO law is also very important because it could because it is part of the legal environment, the part of the legal environment for doing business in most part of the world. So that WTO law is very, very relevant to you, especially when you are advising the policymakers, or you are advising clients. You're advising clients. Even though you advise kind of small clients, right? Not big multinationals. You advise a very SME, a small and medium size enterprise. The WTO law is still useful because the trade and the investment law across the world is very much uniform. So they are very similar across the border. They're very similar across the countries. So China's trade law, investment law are actually very similar to that in Vietnam, in Singapore, in Europe, and in the U.S. because of the WTO framework. Members of the WTO have to apply those rules, have to implement those rules, and they are one of the important functions of the WTO rules is to achieve harmonization and even unification of trade rules. So that's why it's important to understand the WTO law. For example, if you understand the anti-dumping law in the WTO, then there's no problem for you to understand the US anti-dumping law, or the Europe's anti-dumping law. If you can understand the investment law in the WTO, then it's very easy for you to understand the investment law in other countries, that in the China's trading partners. So that's why the WTO law, although it looks very remote, looks very far away, is actually very useful, very useful. Most importantly, it can help you to understand how the international economy, how the international legal system works, international economic law system works. That's the that's why it is important to study WTO law. I normally use these tricks to lure them into our trap here. Otherwise, you will lose your interest in studying world trade law. Right. Let me start with, before we go to the details, we will analyze the legal rules. But before we go into the details, let's spend some time to discuss the philosophical questions. Two questions. What is free trade? And second, whether free trade is good or bad. For a country, whether it's good to conduct free trade or protectionism. So first, what is a free trade? So no restrictions for the movement of goods and services. Right? Goods and services. Then what are the benefits of what are the pros and cons of free trade? For a country, for a particular government, is it good to practice free trade or protected trade, protectionism?
Imports from the foreign country can have a competition to the local enterprise, so the price will be lower than before.
So you're talking two benefits, right? One benefit is for the consumers. The consumers can enjoy goods of a lower price, the good quality goods from other countries, right? And another benefit is competition. Right? So free trade could introduce competition into a market, right? Of course, the assumption is competition is always good. Right? Competition is always good. Of course, the opponents of free trade will question this assumption. They will say competition is not good, or at least is not necessarily good. Okay, free trade or protectionism?
Okay, for consumer, the free trade maybe is always good consumer, but for the enterprises, local enterprises,
okay,
it's hard to see. It's divided in two sides. Okay, for the first, okay, maybe they can evolve in the world competition easily.
Okay.
But of course, they will face the world competition at the same time.
Okay.
But for garment, it depends on the politics, maybe. It's hard or good. And generally speaking, that the free trade for the garment is maybe they lost the control of, they're not easy to control the state economy.
Right.
And on the other hand, the government can use more sources to restrict the inside economy.
How long is the history of free trade? The global free trade. From 19th century. Why is that? Starting from what point? Industrial Revolution. So following the Industrial Revolution, the world began to have free trade. So even after that, all of you have overestimated the history of free trade. Only half a decade. From GATT. Before that, there was no global free trade at all. The two world war occurred because of protectionism, not because of free trade. not because of free trade. Right? For a long time, the world, especially the European powers, believed in mercantilism. So they believe that they should protect their market and protect their producers and encourage exports and discourage imports. So mercantilism, for most part of the world history, protectionism or mercantilism was the main theme. Of global trade. And mercantilism still exists today. And the many, for example, if you ask most of the U.S. congressmen or women, they will believe that China is a mercantilist country. Right? And the Chinese government will, of course, say we are now the flagship of free trade. Right? We uphold free trade. The U.S. is becoming a protectionist country because the U.S. has launched so many protectionist measures, right, against the goods from China. Right? So, but still mercantilism still exists today. It took a long time for because people believed that it's good, right? It's good to encourage exports and discourage imports. Right? It's good for the country. It's good for the economy. It's good for everybody. That was the main way of thinking. For many centuries, so you need intellectual challenge to this mercantilism. So somebody at some point presented to the world a new theory about trade, their theories argue that free trade. By practicing free trade, a country can actually achieve more, get more benefits than doing protectionism. So you need a change of mind. And that theory theory argue that in the past people believed that how strong a nation is depends on how much asset you have, right? But the new theories argue that the nation's wealth is not measured by its asset, but rather by the aggregate economic well-being of the society of the people. You don't have to protect your producers. Certain people might lose, they might suffer, but overall the society benefits by practicing free trade. And by practicing free trade, the government might lose the tariff. But that's not a problem according to the new theories, because that is made up by the domestic taxes and also by the increase of domestic the overall welfare. Right. So what are the revolutionary economic theories in the development of the free trade? Philosophy. Yes, compare absolute and comparative advantage. So what is absolute advantage? What is comparative advantage? Let's start with absolute because that's the first step. Right? Let's start with the definition of absolute advantage.
Every country has good industry.
Okay.
For example, in China, manufacture
competitive industries.
So exports the goods manufactured by China, have absolute advantage.
Okay.
Comparatively, some goods about high tech is non.
So the U.S. is better in some high-tech industries and could export high-tech goods to China, and China could export the goods with lower value added, right, to the U.S. Actually quite interesting. If you look at the economic structure, look at the structure of trade between U.S. and China, it looks very much like China export high-tech stuff to the U.S. And China export computers, electronics. And U.S. exports to us what? Agriculture stuff. Agriculture stuff. That's actually a very interesting development. Right? But part of the reason because the U.S. very much restricts the exports of high-tech goods to China. U.S. does not want to sell high-tech goods to China because it does not want to strengthen the Chinese military. And U.S. agriculture industry is actually relatively very advanced, very very efficient. So that's the absolute advantage argues that the theory of absolute advantage argues that there at the global level there should be a division of labor. One country is good at as a nation state, you must be good at doing something better than others. Then you can focus on those areas and you can export goods and services in those areas in exchange for goods and services in other areas which you are not good at doing. That also applies to every family, to everybody, right? To everybody. That's the absolute advantage. Okay, this the absolute advantage. So if you hire productivity, higher efficiency, you can just focus on those areas. Very much like in the domestic setting, you don't produce everything for yourself. Right, you don't produce your own food. You don't produce your own clothes. Right, you don't produce this computer. You buy it from others. Right, you sell to others something you are good at making. So that's absolute advantage. Right? Specialization. You have a specialization. You have a division of labor. But we still have a question here. What happens? Well, it's possible, right? What happens if the country is good at producing everything? If the country has absolute advantage for producing almost everything, do we still need international trade? The U.S. actually has the best producing capacity for most of the stuff. But the U.S. actually has abandoned many industries. It focused on certain industries. For example, if the U.S. could manufacture computers, right, hardware computers. But the U.S. actually has shifted the computer manufacturing industry to other countries. Right. So the iPad, iPhones, they are now finally assembled in China, produced and manufactured in China. So why in that case, does the U.S. still need to trade with other countries? But according to comparative advantage,